This is The Think Tank, talking about the major political, economic, and social issues of the week. With Dr. Mike O'Neill and hosted by Mike Russell. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com. The Think Tank.
Okay, Mike O'Neill here with guest Steve Goldstein. No Mike Russell this week. We're going to talk about, as advertised, news of the week. Interesting political development, Steve. Bernie Sanders shows up number one in a poll in New Hampshire.
Well, I guess the New Hampshire voters, Mike, are a little bit unpredictable. Do you think there's any possibility with this that Bernie Sanders has excited the base, and at the same time, people are thinking about Hillary Clinton? Well, she's inevitable. At this point, the poll doesn't really matter, so let me just sort of float this. Or do you think, this is what I'm struggling with, is this a Hillary weakness? Is this a Bernie Sanders strength? Or is this just, you know, let's experiment a little bit?
I think it's both. I think Hillary's strongest claim was inevitability. If she is inevitable, then you don't touch her. And Bernie or anybody else, you want to keep him low so he doesn't injure her. The crowds he has attracted have been phenomenal. They have been Obama-like.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I think there is a parallel here. An inevitable Hillary and this guy who nobody gives a chance to starts attracting huge crowds. Now it feels like there's this huge Hillary balloon. If somebody pierces that, we're all up for grabs. You know, if she is no longer inevitable, Joe Biden takes a look at the race and says, am I viable? Bernie Sanders is no longer outside the realm of possibility. The crowds are huge. And I think coming in first, I think there's a psychological shift there. You say, as long as she's winning comfortably, he's getting 25% of the vote. Okay, that's the liberal base. They'll have their little party, and then they'll behave themselves, and they'll vote for Hillary. This feels like, wow, not inevitable.
Your comparison to Obama, I think, is a great one, because, again, it's inspiring people to really want to get out there. But what strikes me is you have a Democratic Party that has been extremely competitive, even more than that when it comes to presidential races over the past couple of decades. You have a Democratic president who got reelected. But with Bernie Sanders, Mike, I can't help but think about early 70s with the Democrats, let's say late 60s when there was this discontent with Lyndon Johnson, and they wanted to be excited about someone else, whether it was McCarthy or whether it was RFK or whatnot. And yet that was the party at a point of weakness. This is a party sort of at a point of strength with an obvious candidate. That's why I wonder if the party faithful are going to be a little nervous about this, because headlines, a lot of people just pay attention to headlines and they see Sanders. Well,
and the attacks on Hillary from the Republicans, I think some of them have started to score. Mm. You know, I've kind of been waiting for her to come and hit back. And she hasn't really yet. Now, it's relatively early. It's not like she doesn't have time, but I want to see what her response is. You know, they're mostly innuendo. You know, it's like, well, what is she hiding? Stuff like that. But, you know, she is going to testify before Congress. And I think that moment will be absolutely seminal. But if I could move just for a second to Bernie Sanders, I think two observations. One is, his positions on a lot of stuff have extremely high support. If you, for example, deal with the issue of the wealth gap, his comments on that resonate. 63% of Americans say the current distribution of wealth is unfair. He wants to get big money out of politics. A majority thinks that Citizens United was wrongly decided. 79% of Americans believe that education beyond high school is unaffordable. Mm-hmm. Student debt is a big thing. All of these are Sanders' position. Global warming, 71% say it's real and man-made. 50% are very worried about global warming. And so you look at all of those. By the way, even among Republicans, 48% said they're more likely to vote for a candidate who wants to fight climate change. Now, those are a lot of his positions, they are very mainstream. He has one huge problem, and that is the bumper sticker.
The S word.
Bernie Sanders, self-described socialist. Now, I think from a substantive standpoint, those people who study this say that, well, that's laughable in the sense that we have socialism. We have Social Security, we have Medicare, we have unemployment insurance, and the argument is really about how much and where. But the term in America has been instant political death, and he is the only elected American official of any stature who has embraced it.
Can he get his points across with what you're saying, these points of view that many Americans agree with, without getting caught up in that? And Mike, I think in a Democratic primary, he can. That's why I think he may, in fact, be a stronger candidate than we give him credit for initially. But if at any point he does start to penetrate or tick that balloon a little bit of Hillary Clinton's, you're going to see this coming out. Again, I've heard you talk about this before, and I think this is true, that people just don't, whether they don't want to take the time or don't have the time, they're going for the bumper sticker thing. All you have to do is put socialist. I'm going back to Hillary for just a moment. When we had all the Republicans in the debate, we had the 10 and one, we had the 7 and the other. Describe Hillary Clinton in a couple of words. Bobby Jindal, a governor of an American state, said socialist. So for Hillary Clinton, that is even a word that people are scared of, apparently.
I think it's harder with Hillary to make it stick. First of all, she hasn't embraced it herself, whereas Bernie Sanders has.
Right.
I see it as a huge, bumper sticker stuff does her, that. A lot of our politics is that. You name a politician and you can almost come up with a one or two word descriptor, and that's the embarkation point. And Bernie Sanders has defined his own.
Does the majority of the high efficacy voters, though, are they concerned enough about what's going on in the country to actually have it spin that way? I think if you had 80% turnout for a presidential election, and we've had good turnout for the presidential elections, but not 80 to 90%, then you might see this really impacting it. Mike, I'm thinking for myself, you have Bernie Sanders making these points, but enough Americans think, well, I wish I made more money. I wish I worked fewer hours, but I didn't get hit by the mortgage mess. I still have my home. I still have my family. I'm doing okay.
You know, I don't think we're getting to 80 or 90%. We're getting, and by the thing that most people don't think about when you look at our elections, we have off-year elections in the 40s. We might hit 60 in a presidential, but probably 55. And there is a huge difference. That's why the Republicans win the off years and the Democrats win the presidential years. It's the difference between 45 and 60. If we went to 80 or 90, the Democrats would run anything, but that's not going to happen.
Right.
So we're going to be back in just a few minutes. And I have an article that I want to run by you, Steve. It's the article's called Confessions of a Congressman, and it's written by a congressman anonymously, and some really interesting observations about what it's really like to be a congressman and what triggers and influences congressional behavior. We'll be back in just a moment in the Think Tank.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
We're back in the Think Tank with NPR's Steve Goldstein, and I have in front of me a really interesting article. It is interesting to me primarily because it is written by a congressman or congresswoman, I don't know the gender, but written anonymously. And the gist of it is, hey, you know, there's a number of things that really drive congressional behavior. Point number one, and there are several bullet points on that. Mm-hmm. Point number one, you know, Congress really is not out of touch with folks back home. They do spend the vast majority of their time back home in the district. There's fewer than 100 days a year of actual legislating. This is about spending your life getting reelected.
Out of touch back home, though, to me means so many different things. Okay, you go back home. Are you meeting with your broad base of constituents, or are you really listening to those who voted for you, Mike? That's one of the things that I always consider when it comes to members of Congress. They do hold town hall meetings. They do hear from people. One would think they get phone calls, emails, faxes from everyone. But who are they really listening to? So we could say is out of touch, yes, you're communicating with people, but are you hearing without listening?
Well, that leads in very directly to point number two, which is Congress listens best to money. Here's the staggering. Again, this is written by a congressman and anonymously. Mm-hmm. Every 2 years, congressman has to be reelected. And his estimate is that they spend, this is staggering, between 50 and 75% of their time is spent raising money.
I wish I could say it was shocking. It's not. It's clear that re-election, when it comes around, this is one of those things that the focus has to be on how much money have I gained. And this is also why, Mike, they seem so tentative about going against the party base, against going against their leadership in the party, because they're so concerned once they get in. And this is what always strikes me as well. A candidate who may be very well-meaning says, I'm going to go back to Washington and change things. Well, too often, it's Washington changes the person. Yeah. You know, Mr. Smith goes to Washington is a dream at this point.
I want to change thing, and the consultant will sit you down and say, listen, if you want to change thing, the first thing you got to do is stick around here for a while. You got to get reelected. In order to get reelected, you need piles of money.
And from whom are they raising the money? I think that's a key as well. Do we know, are they getting $100 donations, or are they getting thousands and thousands of dollars from corporations, from groups that we don't really know about? That seems to be the broader concern. If you have to spend time raising the money, at least tell us where you're getting the money from.
You know, and here's where I think they get to play. There's two different ways, and it's a statistical artifact. Somebody can say, well, a majority of my contributions are from small donors, $25 or less. That can be simultaneously true with the fact that the overwhelming proportion of your money came from big donors. In other words, yes, you've got hundreds and hundreds of small donations, but 90% of your money came from a few larger donations. Mm-hmm. And particularly now with unlimited contributions to allied organizations, the supposedly independent expenditure committee that can take unlimited funds.
I know we're talking about the House, but I wonder just for a moment if we could delve off into the Senate. That's one of the reasons people tend to have slightly more faith in senators, because it's 6 years. They're raising money, yes, but not on this constant day after day after day. 50 to 75% maybe for the last 2 years of the term?
Maybe the last four. You may have a couple of years after you've just been reelected, and maybe for the first 2 years you're saying, maybe I'm not going to run again or something like that.
But why wouldn't gerrymandering make it so the constant fundraising didn't have to happen? Because in many cases, you probably won't have a primary challenger, yep. And in most of these districts, you're not going to have an opposite yep. party challenger.
This is fascinating, because every time
we're prescient here?
No, you've got the next point, which point number three is almost everybody in Congress loves gerrymandering. Why? Well, if it got you elected, you are in a seat. Between 90 and 95% of the seats, there is no chance that somebody in the opposite party will beat you. So who do you fear? You fear a primary challenge in your own primary. That means, generally speaking, if you're a Republican, that challenge is coming from the far right. If you're a Democrat, it's coming from further to the left.
Then why isn't there more effective legislation? I keep thinking about this, where if you are someone who, let's say you're a traditional Republican or a traditional Democrat, you tweak a few percent one or the other. We're not saying you're going to make a drastic shift either further left or further right. Why aren't you more focused? If you don't have to be as concerned about getting reelected, why aren't you coming up with better bills and better legislation? I'm sort of baffled by that.
Well, again, you're raising the money. I think the other thing about the money, and this is that, you know, nobody sits and says, let me raise enough money that I can have a fair fight. What you want to say, it's kind of like nuclear deterrence. You say you want to raise so much money that nobody in their right mind would ever run against you.
Even the term war chest sort of infers that. Well,
it's preemptive. I mean, if you raise enough money, you scare off all significant opposition. Somebody looks at the size of your war chest, and when you got a lot, you announce it. Mm-hmm. You have to public disclosure anyway. But basically, you want the world to know that you've got piles and there's more where that came from. And if somebody takes you on, you're going to bury them.
What do you think the most effective use of that money is in a race that's not going to be close?
Wow. You know, you just overwhelm it. I mean, when there's no race that's not going to be close, you have the wonderful opportunity to run just positive media. You don't have to. I mean, I remember a couple of times when I saw John McCain at his most genteel. There was a teacher that was running against. It was a couple of terms ago. The guy had no chance. He went on the all around the state debating the guy in a very genteel fashion. And you could just see sitting there saying, listen, I'm going to win 60%. I'm going to be nice to this guy. And I'm going to look like I'm totally above politics. Now, if you got into a close race, you could have been sure that, you know, the gloves would come off. But it was pretty clear in this particular instance that wasn't going to be necessary. So you don't have to, you know, upset anybody. Massive positive media. Mm-hmm. Couple more points here. No secret ballot anymore. And what that is a reference to is this is big data. You know, we know public record. We know which elections. We know which party you voted in the primary of. We know what party registration is. But we then marry that to other data. We know what magazines you subscribe to. Tie that to Facebook and comments and things like that. We pretty much know where you stand at an individual level. And that's a staggering difference in the amount of information that's available.
And as a longtime pollster, I mean, you're much more aware of this than I, but I've been shocked by how closely we come to an election and as much mail-in balloting as there is these days. And the campaigns will know, have you voted yet? If not, what's keeping you? Let me send you a few more mailers.
It's actually even beyond the data. Polling data is good for telling you, okay, middle-aged white voters of this income level are disposed to this. It tells you about people collectively, but big data actually goes beyond that. It says, well, you might be, a college-educated, upper-middle-class somebody, 40 to 55 years old, but we also happen to know that you subscribe to Guns and Ammo magazine, and that tells us something quite different.
No question. It is amazing how much they know about us now. Yeah.
We'll be back with Steve Goldstein in just a minute.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
We're back with news junkie Steve Goldstein, and we're talking about a variety of topics in the political arena. I had some observations about the first political debate, and I wanted to take that in terms of the issue of what would we like to see in a president? What is the job really required? And I'm struck by the disconnect between that and the nature of our debates, this one in particular. And that is the following. I think of what would we like in a president? A president is going to sit there and have access to the best advice in the world. You're going to bring in the expert on whatever experts, multiple experts on a given topic. And what you want is somebody who has the ability to sift through all of that information, take in almost every case as much time as you want, usually weeks or months, you know, maybe in a crisis hours, but certainly not seconds, and make the wisest decision. And then I look at the debate that we had. And by the way, it was great theater. It was fun. But look at what happens. The journalist asks a question of the candidate. They have 1 minute to respond. Now, 90% of the time, they don't even have to think on their feet because most of the questions inherently are going to be fairly predictable. Because if you didn't ask the predictable questions, then everybody's going to be disappointed. Everybody's talking about X. We want to know what you feel about X. In the case of Donald Trump, you know, the first question, which was ostensibly asked of everybody, but really was asked of Donald Trump, which was, if you don't get the nomination, will you run as an independent? That is the logical question. And you got to believe in almost every instance, they have a 60-second answer prepared, scripted, written for them, and practiced. And why 60 seconds? Because that's what you're going to give. They're going to give you. And your objective as a candidate is to look as decisive as, because we like decisive sounding people, right? We
bold
like people.
Leaders.
Bold leader. As opposed to, when is the last time you ever heard anybody in a presidential debate say, well, that's an interesting question. There are two sides to this, and I would have to carefully sift. Somebody does that, they're going to be accused of waffling, right?
But it's also the case, Mike, and I want to go deeper with what you've said, to go back a little bit in history again, and I think about Arizona's former governor, Bruce Babbitt, when he ran for president. I'm going to stand up to prove I'm going to raise taxes. Well, no one else stood up with him, and we saw how Babbitt did in the race. There's that feeling of, if you really have a plan, it's easier to say, well, I'm going to rewrite the tax code, because that's going to save us a lot of money. I'm not going to sign this deal with Iran.
I'm going to have the tax, and we can put it on a postcard, right?
Yeah, exactly. We talk about bumper sticker politics.
Yeah, and I talk to lawyers about that, and they say, you know why you can't do that? One of the reasons you can't do that is defining income is an inherently complex thing. You know, if you're sitting there and all you got is a W-2 from a salary, it's pretty simple. But there are gifts, there's just a whole lot of things that are, well, when I was in graduate school, I got a stipend. And is that technically, to talk about the definition of income, if you earn something, if I do some work for something, then that's taxable income. If it's just given to me, then it's not. And so this was kind of gray area. And this was money coming indirectly from the government. And its taxability was gray area.
In a broader sense with these candidates, I almost feel like people who go on Match.com know more about their date than we know about these presidential candidates, especially someone like Donald Trump, who doesn't have a record of serving in Congress or the governorship or whatever it may be. So I feel like when you have these one-minute answers and these one-minute debates, what exactly are we learning?
Yeah, we're learning at this point. You know, here's my final take on this particular debate. Notwithstanding the fact that I think it's a lousy way to select a president, I think this one debate had a constructive byproduct, and that was building an audience. 24 million people watched. I think that's more than any other debate, certainly any other early on debate. If the byproduct of this is to engage the public, I think that's a good thing. And you really didn't have to decide who you're going to vote for in this debate because nobody votes for another 6 months.
To avoid taking us off on a tangent, I will say, though, how much of that was the Trump factor?
All of it. You know, Trump has said, you got 24 million. If it weren't for me, you would have had 2 million. That may be a, well, he is prone to exaggerate. And that probably was an exaggeration. But there was also a great deal of truth in that.
I absolutely believe that. No question.
You know, the other thing about this is you look at the style. We love people who come across as decisive. I think that's some of the Trump appeal. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm going to do this. I'm going to do this. Obviously, he hasn't been pushed, and that format really didn't on, okay, now you're going to, for example, you're going to build a wall and you're going to send the bill to Mexico. Okay, now how is it that you're going to get them to pay for it? They're going to laugh at you. You know, I mean, but it sounds good. You know, we want to have this thing because we want a secure border and would really love to have somebody else pay for it. You know, that sounds great, but how do you pull it off? He hasn't really gone there.
At the risk of sounding contradictory, because I think from what I know, and of course, being a proud American, I feel like this is the best system. Absolutely. But I do wonder sometimes, Mike, we talk about the vice president being ineffectual for the most part. How wild would it be, hypothetical, if we had a president and a CEO, and the president was someone like a Ronald Reagan, and the CEO was someone who was more like, at least how we view President Obama, maybe someone like Mitt Romney, more of a technician, and someone who really wants to get in there and dig in on the issues, and then we have the other person who sort of gets the message out.
I'll give you an attribute that I like even better than that. And we could talk in a minute about, you know, businessmen, CEOs. I think that's often an ill fit. But I think there is one type of person who would be an ideal fit for what the job of president really entails. And we never see anybody like that running for office, and that is a scientist. Think about back again the scenario. You are given a lot of information, often conflicting information, and the real most important job of president is to sift through that and come to the best possible conclusion. That's what scientists do. There's a scientific way of thinking of the world, being willing to confront information that is hostile to your presumptions, and sift through it in a way that you make sense out of it.
Do our presidents, either those who've been close to the presidency or actually were successful enough to win, do you think they are, if we were to put a percentage, the scales of justice here, if we have logic versus emotion, where is it?
Well, unfortunately, emotion certainly drives the body politic, the voters, you know, I mean, it is, and I've seen, you know, literature on this. I mean, emotional appeals, unfortunately, are the most compelling.
But do we think, do our presidents give into that?
My guess is they're actually a lot less emotional than the appeals that they run, okay. You know, but if you're trying to appeal to the public, the actually emotion and there's one other source of appeal, and that is, I'm just like you. I've watched in your, and that's why we have presidents constantly trying to appear to be, you know, everyday folks. And the last thing you want, one of the most negative, is to be aloof and elitist. And so, for example, you know, we've had a lot of presidents who went to Harvard, but you never see, you see that downplayed. You know, I'm just, Bill Clinton, country folks, right? You know, we didn't hear much about Yale Law School, okay, or that kind of background, because people have, because identification is a stronger, compelling argument to most people than, for example, expertise.
But isn't that often why we hear, who would you like to sit down and have a beer with? And my feeling is, if it's a retired president, I like that question. If it's a current president, I don't really care who I want to have a beer with. I want to make sure if he's talking to the right people and getting the right advice.
Well, Steve, I agree with you, but I think we're in the minority. that I have a beer factor. Yeah, in terms of selecting a president, I don't think it ought to matter, but I think it does. And I think it the mechanism that it works through is, do you identify with this person? If you want to have a beer with them, you tend to identify with them, and that makes them appealing as a candidate.
Well, going back to what we started the program with, Bernie Sanders certainly seems to fit that.
Yeah, incredibly. We were just to bring you a full circle on that. I've been here. I got a millennial nephew, and I'm getting a series of emails from him, and almost never. There's a level of excitement there. And you look at the size of his crowds, and it's very interesting, and it may be underrated at this point. So we will close this out with Steve Goldstein and be back. You're listening to KTR News 92.3 FM. You're in the Think Tank.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
We are back with Steve Goldstein, talking all things political. You're in the Think Tank. And by the way, a little blurb of advertising. We have podcast archived at mikeoneill.org. All but the last podcast or two is available there. There is a link there back to the KTAR site where you can pick up the last two. If you try to find us directly in KTAR, good luck. It's too comp. We are buried deep, deep in the bowels of KTAR.com. But if you go to mikeoneill.com, press radio, there'll be a link that'll take you right back there. I was on the subject of sort of the use of science and how a scientist would be, not a bad attribute for an elected official who, after all, has to make complex decisions. One of the things I think we forget is that the problems that a president faces, if they were simple, they would have already been solved. The only problems left are the complicated ones.
Mm-hmm.
And we want simple solutions, but they're hard to find. You know,
Mike, one thing that struck me that I meant to mention that I didn't is in the midst of the Iran nuclear deal, we've heard all the controversy. We have Republicans lined up on one side, most Democrats lined up on the other, although we've seen Senator Schumer go the other way.
Yep.
Senator Bob Corker, Republican from Tennessee, was very concerned initially about even the progress that was being made mm-hmm. in these talks. But he made a point of saying that when Ernest Moniz, and forgive me, what is he the secretary of?
Energy.
Thank you.
And a scientist.
Exactly, a scientist.
Yep.
After he testified before the Senate, Senator Corker said, I feel better about this. Now, I don't know if he's going to vote that way. Mm-hmm. So I feel better about this hearing from a scientist who could really tell me what's going on here as opposed to another politician.
I think you're absolutely on point. And this is exactly the kind of question, I think, where that is precisely the kind of expertise. Because we've got a complicated matter. We at one level, you look at the top levels of the Iranian government, and that gives you pause. There's some crazies at the top. I think we also forget that to an unusual degree in the Middle East, they've got a very substantial and quite reasonable middle class that is not crazy about their own government. But you look at their behaviors and you say, all right, I don't want them to get a nuclear weapon. I would like to keep that as far out in the future as possible, and you get a complicated deal that nobody's going to read, okay?
Yeah.
Certainly not the average citizen's not going to read, but you're going to say, all right, what is the situation right now if we have no deal? What's the timeline? And on the other hand, if you put in this deal, does it elongate the timeline or does it contract it? And that is where we should go to the people who would actually have the technical expertise just to monitor and say, if we implement this deal, this is what they can do, this is what they can't do, this is where we can get access, this is what, and that is the, without getting into arguing this point, I think that ought to be the basis on which a decision is made. And, you know, I think highly of Bob Corker for basically looking at that information.
Well, it does seem that we'd be better off if we... Again, we all know about political appointees. Many of these positions are based on politics or based on favors and whatnot. But to have someone in a position like that who is a scientist, who has this resume, who can explain things, boy, I think it'd be great if we had a Treasury Secretary who is a scientist in that sense as well, someone who's really an economist. That might be helpful as well.
I think that's actually my personal observation. Some of the biggest difference between different presidents is whether or not they bring in people at the mid-level, agency head level, who are really subject matter specialists as opposed to politicians. Now, of course, you have to have a certain political sensitivity to function as well.
Sure.
But I'd like somebody as Energy Secretary, and I think we have such a case there, who basically understands what is essentially a scientific mission.
This is unbelievable.
NOAA is another
stuff.
Example. National Oceanographic Atmosphere. Mm-hmm. There's a scientist in there. You have to have certain political sensitivities. Just to go back, there was a old friend of mine, by the way, was appointed head of the census, and Bob Groves, and very, very respected academic survey researcher, which is the name us pollsters really prefer. And interestingly, he had one obstacle, and that was the political obstacle, because some years before, when he was appointed the head of the methodology section of the census, he had expressed an opinion, which is, I think, scientifically unassailable, but that opinion was that you would get more accurate congressional apportionment if you used estimates than actual hard head counts. And the reason is the hard head counts are subject to all sorts of very well-known biases. Who's harder? I mean, you don't pick up homeless people and you just can't count them all, but you can your estimates are better than your actual head counts, and that is scientifically unassailable. There was a political dimension to this, however. The political dimension is as follows. The more people you count, the more people you end up putting in Democratic districts. Because guess what? Income correlates with partisanship. Lower income is more Democrat. If you count more homeless people, the Democrats are going to do better. Ergo, Republicans don't like estimates. And in order to get nominated, he had to announce that he had, revised his position. I'm not for any estimation. And I know that at a personal level, everything in his technical background argued against it. Interestingly, he told me later on, now he was in office for a couple of years at the point in time, he said his best buddies in the Congress were now the Republicans, because there were a number of things that he had proposed. And this, again, goes back to estimation, that you could do things with relatively small sample surveys as opposed to population studies and save a boatload of money. And the Republicans were in favor of that with respect to absolutely everything, with the exception of congressional apportionment. So he was a basically application of scientific principles of sampling to do things on the cheap, except when you're apportioning congressional seats. Another point on the scientific case, and this was some time back, where we look at the wrong thing. There was a study done. It was the middle of the Ebola scare. And there was a poll done showed 80% of the public want people who enter the U.S. from West Africa to be quarantined. Mm-hmm. Well, you go to the CDC and you ask them about that. They said that would be the worst possible thing to do. And these people are epidemiologists and they study that. And what they said was, the problem with that is if you completely quarantine anybody from West Africa, people from there are going to figure out how to sneak back in and they're not going to tell you. What you really want to do, they said, is find out whether actually somebody had any higher risk of exposure, and you quarantined them based on an actual sign, not on an across-the-board thing.
That's indicative to me, Mike, of I don't want to call it an anti-intellectualism, because I don't think it's that strong, but there is this feeling of people are explaining things that I don't understand. Again, going back to, I don't really have the time to understand it, so maybe they're trying to convince me of something that isn't true. They can't convince me of something that my eyes are telling me, or that a cable network is telling me that, watch out, Chris Christie was making noise about that at the time, the nurse from New Jersey, and he was telling her, you better not go out on your bike, I'm going to quarantine you.
I thought she won that debate, though.
I think she'll win.
Yes. And that was just it. And I think what it was, it's there are things that we should not settle with a public opinion poll. We got to understand what they're good for. If you want to understand people's sensibilities, that's one thing. You got to deal with that. But when 80% of the public says, let's not let anybody in the country from West Africa, what they're really saying is, I am scared of Ebola. Do something.
Someone coughs next to me, maybe they have Ebola.
The how you do it ought to be deferred to an expert. And this is tough, though, because the political official generally can say, well, I'm gonna do this, I'm going to do that. Or, for example, there was a lot of opposition to Obama sending medical personnel to Africa to deal with the problem when the epidemiologists were telling us, if you want to keep Ebola out of the United States, what you want to do is contain it in Africa, not wait till it gets here.
Right. If we have these scientists who are courageous enough to do it and they want to stop it there, we need to send them.
And I think that, to me, is a broader theme in our politics. It's almost, at the extreme, it's almost the celebration of ignorance. But a lack of willingness to listen dispassionately to expert opinion in those instances when those opinions might differ from what public's instinctive reaction is.
I also think the issue we're running into is sort of the short attention span theater, which is if you can explain it to me in short bites, I can accept it. Otherwise, this is just, it's just too complicated. I don't understand.
And the problem, again, is the problems that we have on our plate are inherently not simple. If they were that simple, we would have already fixed them.
And if we fixed them, there'd be another one around the pike.
And that's why we have the think tank, hopefully taking us just a little bit deeper than we often go. Thank you, Steve Goldstein.
Thank you, Mike.
It's been a treat and an enlightenment.